Some nights he doesn't come at all. Some nights he comes and spends the night kneeling in prayer at the foot of the bed, the whole night, Jacquetta. What do you expect me to do?
I didn't know it was so bad, I say. I'm sorry. I had no idea.
You must know, she says bitterly. You're lying. You know, all my ladies know. You come to wake us in the morning and we're lying side by side, as if we were dead and made of stone on our tombs. Have you ever caught us wrapped in each other's arms? Have you ever heard us call through the door, not now, come back later? You have only to look at him, and you would know. You cannot imagine that he is a lusty, passionate man who is going to father a strong son on me. We don't even rumple the sheets.
Oh, Margaret, I am so sorry, I say tenderly. Of course I didn't think he was lusty, but I did think that he came to your bed and did his duty. She shrugs her shoulders.
Sometimes he does, she says bitterly. Sometimes he rises up from his prayers, crosses himself, and makes a feeble effort. Can you think how that feels? But he doesn't have his heart in it. It's almost worse than nothing at all, an act of duty. It chills my skin, it makes me shudder. I look at you, Jacquetta, and I see you with a baby in your belly every year, and I see how Richard looks at you, and how you steal away early from dinner to be together, even now. And I know it's not the same for me. It is never going to be the same for me.
I'm sorry, I say. She turns her face away and rubs her eyes.
It is not the same for me. It will never be the same for me. I will never be loved like you are loved. And I think I'm dying inside, Jacquetta.
Grafton, Northamptonshire, autumn 1452. I withdraw from court in the autumn to spend some time with my children, and to make sure that my lands are in good heart at Grafton Manor, and my tenants paying their rents and not whispering behind their hands against the king and court. I'm glad to be away. Without the company of Richard, I find I am impatient with the flirtations and excitement of the ladies-in-waiting, and I cannot like the new vindictiveness that I see developing in the king. The Duke of Somerset says that the king is showing his power, growing into majesty, but I cannot admire it. They are calling his progress a harvest of heads, and saying that every summer he will work his way around the counties where men have risen against him, or even spoken against him, and judge like a modern Solomon. He seems to take equal pleasure in tenderly pardoning as in harsh sentencing. And no man can know, when he's called before this king, whether he's going to meet a saint or a tyrant. Some men are paraded before him naked, with a halter round their necks, and he sees their shame and their weakness, and forgives them with tears, letting them kiss his hands and praying with them. Another old lady defies him with a curse, refuses to confess to anything, and she's hanged. The king weeps then, too, in sorrow for a sinner. And I am glad to be away from the queen's rooms, where I see that she grows closer and closer to Edmund Beaufort. They are thrown together all the time by the king's need of him, and it means that Margaret, still only a young woman of 22, is in the constant company of the man who commands England, who advises her husband and counsels her. Of course she admires him. Her husband holds him up as the very model of a perfect lord. He is the most handsome man at court. He is regarded as the champion of England, and he's clearly in love with her. He looks after her as she goes by. He whispers in her ear. He takes her hand on the least pretext, and places himself beside her, her partner in games, her companion in walks. His horse rides next to hers. Of course she knows that she may not feel anything for him but respect and cousinly affection. But she's a young and passionate woman, and he is a seductive man. I think that no power in the world could stop her looking for him, smiling when she sees him, and simply glowing with joy when he comes to sit beside her and whispers in her ear. And as for the king, he rests on the duke, as if Edmund is his only comfort and his peace of mind. Ever since the rise of Jack Cade, when the king fled from London, he cannot feel safe in his own capital city, nor in any of the counties of the south. He may go through them every summer, dispensing his spiteful justice with the gallows, but he knows he is not beloved. He only feels safe in the middle lands of England, at Leicester, Kenilworth, and Coventry. He relies on Edmund Beaufort to assure him that despite all appearances, everything is well. Edmund reports that he is beloved, the people faithful, the court and the men of the household honest, Calais secure, and Bordeaux certain to be restored. It is a comforting list, and Beaufort is persuasive. His warm, honeyed tongue seduces the king and the queen together. The king praises Edmund to the skies as his only reliable adviser. He lauds him as the man whose military skill and courage will save us from rebels great and small. He thinks that Edmund can manage the Parliament, that Edmund understands the Commons, and all the time the Queen smiles and says that Edmund is a very great friend to them both, and she will go riding with him the next morning while the king prays in his chapel. She has learnt to be cautious. She knows well enough that she is watched all the time and that people judge her harshly. But her pleasure in his company and his hidden desire for her is apparent to me, and this is enough to make me glad to leave a court with this dangerous secret at the very heart of it. Richard is to come home to me at last, and sends to tell me he is on his way. We are to celebrate the marriage of Elizabeth. She is 15, ready for marriage, and the boy whom I'd picked out in my mind, and whose name I had whispered to the new moon, has found the courage to speak to his mother about her. Lady Grey herself wrote to me with a proposal that her son John might marry our daughter. I knew that if Elizabeth stayed in their house for any length of time, John Grey would fall in love with her, and his parents would see the benefit of the match. And she picked the apple blossom and gave him the fruit to eat. She's more than pretty. She has real beauty. And Lady Grey cannot bear to refuse her beloved son anything. Besides, as I foresaw, Lady Grey is a woman of her own mind, a commander of her own acres, a queen in her county. And once she had the training of my daughter, she soon believed that no better-mannered girl could exist. She taught her how the linen room should be. She preached to her the value of well-trained maids. She took her into the dairy to watch as they churned the famous Groby butter and skimmed the fat cream. She taught her how to keep the account books and to write a civil letter to the Grey kinsmen all around the country. Together they climbed the little hill that they call Tower Hill and looked over the Ferrers' acres, and Lady Grey remarked that all this had come to her on the death of her father. She had brought it to Sir Edward on their marriage, and now her beloved son John will inherit it all. Elizabeth, who knew well enough how to run a household, who knew how to prepare herbs for the still-room, and indeed knows how they should be grown and when harvested, who knows the properties of 100 plants and how to call the venom out of them, she is my daughter, after all, had the good sense and the good manners never to correct the lady of the house, but simply learnt how it was done at Groby. Of course, she already knew how linen should be folded, or cream skimmed. She knew how a county lady should command her maids. Actually, she knows far more than Lady Grey will ever dream, for she has learnt from me how a royal court is run, and how things were done in the courts of France and of Luxembourg. But she accepted the orders of the woman who would be her mother-in-law, as a polite young woman should, and gave every appearance of a girl eager to learn the right way that things should be done, the Groby way. In short, as she picked and dried the herbs for the Groby still-room, prepared the oils, polished the silver, and watch the cutting of the strewing rushes. My daughter enchanted the hard-hearted Lady of Groby, just as she enchanted the son of the house. It is a good match for her. I had it in mind for years. She has my name and her father's position in our country, but next to no dowry. Service to this king has not brought us a fortune. It seems profitable only for those lords who take their fees and do nothing. Those courtiers who do nothing but sympathize with the king and conspire with his wife can take a great profit, as we see from the rich lands that were given to William de la Pole, and the extraordinary wealth that Edmund Beaufort now enjoys. But my husband took 60 lances and nearly 600 archers with him to Calais, all trained under his command, all wearing our livery, and all paid by us. The treasury has promised to reimburse us, but they might as well date the tally sticks the day of judgment. For the dead will rise from their graves before we can take the sticks into the treasury and get a full repayment. We have a new name and a beautiful house. We have influence and a reputation. We are trusted by both the king and the queen. But money? No. We never have any money. With this marriage, my Elizabeth will become Lady Grey of Groby, mistress of a good part of Leicestershire, owner of Groby Hall, and the other great properties in the Grey family, kinswoman to all the Greys. It is a good family, with good prospects for her, and they are solidly for the king and fiercely opposed to Richard, Duke of York, so we will never find her on the wrong side if the dispute between the Duke of York and his rival, the Duke of Somerset, grows worse. Elizabeth is to go to her wedding from our house with her father and me, and all the children except the two babies. But Richard is not yet home. "Where is father?" she asks me the day before we're due to leave. "You said he would be here yesterday." "He will come," I say steadily. "What if he's been delayed? What if he couldn't get a ship? What if the seas were too rough to sail? I cannot be married without him to give me away. What if he doesn't get here?" I put my hand on my wedding ring, as if to touch his fingers that placed it there. "He will be here," I say. "Elizabeth, in all the years that I have loved him, he has never failed me. He will be here." She frets all the day, and I send her to bed that night with a tisane of valerian. And when I peep into her room, she's fast asleep in her bed, her hair plaited under her nightcap, seeming as young as her sister Anne, who shares the bed with her. Then I hear the noise of horses in the stable yard and look from her window, and there is the river's standard, and there is my husband, heaving himself wearily from his horse. And in a moment I am down the stairs and out through the stable door and in his arms. He holds me so tightly that I can hardly breathe, and then he turns my face up to his and kisses me. "I dare say I stink," is the first thing he says when he gets his breath. "You must forgive me. The tide was against us, and so I've ridden hard to get here tonight. You knew I would not fail you, didn't you?" I smile up at his handsome, well-worn, well-loved face, the man I have adored for so many years. "I knew you would not fail me." The Greys have a small chapel at their house, opposite the great hall, where the young couple exchange the vows and are solemnly witnessed by both sets of parents and the brothers and sisters. Our family fills up the chapel. I can see Lady Grey look at the ranks of my children and think that her son is marrying fertile stock. After the wedding we walk through the cloister to the hall, and there is a feast and singing and dancing, and then we prepare them for bed. Elizabeth and I are alone in the bedroom that is going to be hers. It is a beautiful room, looking north over the pleasure grounds, towards the meadows and the river. I am feeling tender-hearted. This is my girl, the first child of mine, to marry and leave her home. "What do you foresee for me, Lady Mother?" she asks.
This is a question I have been dreading. You know I don't foresee any more, I say. That was something in my girlhood. They don't like such things in England, and I have put it aside. If it comes to me, or to you, it is without our bidding. Your father does not like it. She gives a little giggle. Oh, Lady Mother, she says reproachfully, that you should stoop so low, and on my wedding day. I cannot help but smile. Stoop so low as to what? As to lie, she whispers. And to me, on my wedding day. I understand now that you foresaw that John would love me, and I him. I picked the apple blossom, and I gave him the apple, just as you said. But long before that, the moment I first saw him, I knew exactly what you intended when you sent me here. I was standing before his mother when she was at her table in the rents room. And he came in the door behind her. I hadn't even known he was at home, and the moment I saw him, I knew why you'd sent me to Groby, and what you thought would happen. And were you glad? Was I right to send you? Her joy shines out of her bright grey eyes. Very glad. I thought if he were to like me, I should be the happiest girl in England. That was not foreseeing. That was nothing more than knowing that you are beautiful and lovable. I could have sent you to any handsome young man's household, and he would have fallen in love with you. There was no magic in that, but a girl and a boy in springtime. She's glowing. I'm glad. I wasn't sure. I'm glad that he is in love, but not enchanted. But surely, you have looked to see my future. Did you put the charms in the river? What did you draw from the waters? Did you look for us in the cards? What will my future be? I didn't read the cards. I lied to her, my little daughter. I lie barefaced like a hard-hearted old witch, denying the truth on her wedding night, and I lied to her with my face completely serene. I am going to tell her a lie that is utterly convincing. I will not have my foresight overshadowing her present happiness. I will deny my gift, deny what it has shown me. You are mistaken, my dear. I didn't read the cards, and I didn't look in a mirror. I didn't put any charms in the river because I didn't have to. I can predict your happiness without any craft, just as I knew he would love you. I can tell you that I know you will be happy. And I think there will be children, and the first one quite soon. Girl or boy? You'll be able to tell that yourself, I smile, now that you have your own wedding ring. And I will be Lady Grey of Groby, she says, with quiet satisfaction. I feel a shiver, like a cold hand on the nape of my neck. I know that she will never inherit here. Yes, I say, defying my better knowledge. You will be Lady Grey of Groby, and the mother of many fine children. This is what she must hear as she goes into her wedding bed on her wedding night. God bless you, my darling, and give you joy. The girls tap on the door and come into the room in a flurry, with rose petals for the bed and the jug of wedding ale and a bowl of scented water for her to wash with, and her linen gown. And I help her get ready. And when the men come in, boisterous and drunk, she is lying in her bed like a chaste little angel. My husband and Lord Grey help John in beside her, and he blushes furiously like a boy, though he is 21, and I smile as if I'm wholly happy. And I wonder what it is that stops my heart in fear for the two of them. In 2 days we go back to our own house at Grafton, and I never tell Elizabeth, or anyone, that I did indeed read the cards for her the very day that Lady Grey wrote to me to ask what dowry Elizabeth might bring to the marriage. I sat at the table, looking out over the water meadow and the dairy,
certain of her happiness, and took the cards in my hand. I turned over three, chosen at random, and all three were blank. The card maker had put three spare cards in the pack when he first painted the pictures. Three cards just like the others with brightly coloured backs, but nothing on the front. Spares for use in another game. And it was the three cards with nothing to say that came to my hand when I went to foresee Elizabeth's future with John Grey. I'd hoped to see prosperity and children, grandchildren, and a rise in the world. But the cards were empty of anything. There was no future that I could see for Elizabeth and John Grey. No future for them at all. Palace of Placentia, Greenwich, London, Christmas 1452. Richard and I attend the court at Greenwich for Christmas, and find the festivities and the hunts and the music and the dancing all under the command of Edmund Beaufort, who is such a centre of the happiness of the court that he's almost a king himself. He makes much of Richard, recommending him to the king as the man certain to hold Calais for us, and often takes him aside to discuss how an English expedition might force its way out of the Calais lands into Normandy once more. Richard follows his usual rule of fealty and loyalty to his commander, and I say nothing about the way that the Queen's eyes follow them when they talk together. But I know I have to speak to her again. I am forced to speak to her, driven to it, by a sense of duty. I almost smile to feel so bound, for I know this is the influence of my first husband, John, Duke of Bedford. He never avoided a difficult duty in his life, and I feel as if he's laid on me the obligation to serve England's Queen, even if it means challenging her behaviour and calling her to account. I choose a moment when we're preparing for a masque of Edmund Beaufort's planning. He has ordered that the Queen should have a gown of white, fastened high at the waist with a plaited gold cord, and that her hair should be loose. She is supposed to represent a goddess, but she looks like a bride. He has designed new sleeves for the white gown, cut so short and so wide that you can see her arms almost to the elbow. "You will have to wear another set of sleeves," I say frankly. "These are quite indecent." She strokes the inside of her arm. "It feels so lovely," she says. "My skin feels like silk. It feels so wonderful to be this..."
"Naked," I finish for her. And without another word, I find another pair of sleeves in her chest of clothes and start to lace them on. She lets me exchange the sleeves without a word of complaint, and then sits before her mirror. I wave away her maid and take the hairbrush to stroke out the tangles from the long red-gold ringlets that fall almost to her waist. "The noble Duke Edmund Beaufort pays you much attention," I say. "It is noticeable, Your Grace." She gleams with pleasure.
"Ah, you said before, Jaquetta, this is an old song. But he looks at me as a good courtier, a chevalier."
"He looks like a man in love," I say bluntly, expecting to shock her. But I am horrified to see the colour flame in her cheeks.
"Oh, does he?" she asks.
"Does he really?" "Your Grace, what is happening? You know you should not be speaking of real love. A little poetry, a little flirtation is one thing. But you cannot think of him with desire."
"When he speaks to me, I come alive."
She addresses my reflected image in the mirror, and I see her face gleaming and silvery through the looking-glass. It is as if we are in another world, the world of the scrying mirror. And such things can be said.
"With the king, it is as if I'm caring for a child. I have to tell him that he's in the right, that he should ride out like a man, that he should rule like a king. I have to praise him for his wisdom and coax him when he's upset. I'm more a mother to him than a lover. But Edmund... She gives a little shuddering breath, lowers her eyes, and then looks up at the mirror and shrugs, as if there's nothing she can do.
You must stop seeing him, I say hastily. Or only see him when others are present. You must keep your distance.
She takes the brush from my hand. Don't you like him? She asks. He says he likes and admires you. He says he's your friend. And he trusts Richard above all others. He praises him to the king.
Nobody could help but like him, I say. He is handsome, charming, and one of the greatest men in England, but that doesn't mean that the Queen should feel anything for him but cousinly affection.
You're too late to tell me, she says, her voice silky and warm. It's too late for me. It's not cousinly affection. It is far beyond that. Jaquetta, for the first time in my life I feel as if I'm alive. For the first time in my life I feel as if I'm a woman. I feel beautiful. I feel desired. I cannot resist this.
I told you before, I remind her. I warned you.
Again, she lifts her beautiful shoulders. Oh, Jaquetta, you know as well as I do what it is to be in love. Would you have stopped if someone had warned you?
I don't answer her. You will have to send him away from court, I say flatly. You will have to avoid him, perhaps for months. This is a disaster.
I can't, she says. The king would never allow him to go. He won't let him out of his sight. And I would just die if I didn't see him, Jaquetta. You don't know. He is my only companion. He is my chevalier. He is my champion. The Queen's champion.
This is not Camelot, I warn her grimly. These are not the times of the troubadours. People will think badly of you if they see you so much as smile at him. They will accuse him of being your favourite. Or worse. What you are saying here is enough to have you put aside and sent to a nunnery. And if anyone heard you say it, it would be the end of him. Already he is hated and envied for being the favourite of the king. If one word gets out to the people that you favour him, they will say the most terrible things. You are the queen, and your reputation is like Venetian glass, precious and fragile and rare. You have to take care. You are not a private lady. You cannot have private feelings.
I will take care, she says breathlessly. I swear, I will take care.
It's as if she's bartering for the right to be with him, and that she would offer anything for that right.
If I take care, if I don't smile on him or ride too close to him or dance with him too often, I can still see him. Can't I? Everyone will think he's with us all the time at the king's command. Nobody need know that he makes me so happy, that it makes my life worth living just to be with him.
I know I should tell her that she should never be alone with him at all, but her face is too imploring. She is lonely, and she is young, and it is miserable to be a young woman in a great court when nobody really cares for you. I know that. I know what it's like to have a husband who hardly sees you, but that there is one young man who can't take his eyes from you. I know what it's like to burn up in a cold bed. Just take care, I say, though I know I should tell her to send him away. You will have to be careful all the time, every day of your life, and you cannot see him alone. You must never be alone with him. This cannot go beyond the chevalier and his honourable love for his lady. It cannot go beyond your secret joy. It has to stop here. She shakes her head.
I have to talk with him, she says. I have to be with him.
You cannot. There can be no future for the two of you but shame and disgrace. She leaves her mirror and moves to the great bed with the rich golden hangings. She pats it invitingly, and slowly I come towards her.
Will you draw a card for him? She asks.
Then we would know the answers. Then we would know what future there might be. I shake my head. You know that the king doesn't like the cards, I say. It is forbidden.
Just one card. Just once. So that we might know what is to come. So that I will take care.
I hesitate, and in a moment she is at the bedroom door and calling for a pack of playing cards. One of the ladies offers to bring them through, but the queen takes them at the bedroom door and hands them to me.
Go on, she says.
Slowly I take the cards and shuffle them. Of course we play cards all the time at court, but the feeling of them in my hand as I seek only one, seek to divine the future, is quite different. I hand them to her. Shuffle them. Then cut the cards, I say very quietly, and cut them again. Her face is entranced. We will foretell his future? I shake my head. We cannot foretell his future. He would have to ask for the card. He would have to choose. We can't do it without him. But we can tell how his life will touch yours. We can see which card shows his feeling for you and yours for him. She nods.
I want to know that,
she whispers longingly.
Do you think he loves me, Jacquetta?
You've seen him with me.
Do you think he loves me?
Spread the cards, I say. She makes a fan of the cards, their bright faces downwards. Now choose. Slowly, one finger moving across the painted backs, she muses on her choice, and then she points.
This one.
I turn it over. It is the Falling Tower. The tower of a castle, perhaps struck by lightning, a jagged streak of light flaming into the roof of the tower, the walls going one way, the roof the other. Two little figures fall from the tower to the grass below.
What does it mean? She whispers. Will he take the tower? Does it mean he will take the kingdom?
For a moment, I cannot understand her meaning. Take the kingdom? I repeat in horror. Take the kingdom? She shakes her head, denying the very thought, hand over her mouth.
Nothing, nothing. But what does it mean? This card. What does it mean?
It means an overturning of all things, I say. Disruption of the times. Perhaps a fall of a castle. Of course, I think of Richard, who is sworn to hold the castle of Calais for this very commander. A fall from on high. Look, here are two people falling down from the tower, a rising of those who are low, and in the end, everything different. A new heir takes the throne. The old order is changed. Everything is new. Her eyes are shining. Everything is new, she whispers. Who do you think is the king's true heir? I look at her in something close to horror. Richard, Duke of York, I say flatly. Like him or not, Richard, Duke of York, is the king's heir. She shakes her head.
Edmund Beaufort is the king's cousin, she whispers. He could be the true heir. Perhaps this is what the card means.
It never comes out quite how I think it will be, I warn her. This is not a prediction. It is always more like a warning. Do you remember the Wheel of Fortune card? The card you drew on your wedding day that promises what rises will fall, that nothing is certain. Nothing I can say can dull her joy. Her face is shining. She thinks I've foreseen the change of everything, and she's longing for something to change. She thinks that the tower shown in the card is her prison. She wants it broken down. She thinks the people who are clearly falling are breaking free. She thinks the lightning shaft that destroys and burns will break down the old and make new. There is nothing I can say that she will hear as a warning. She makes the gesture that I showed her on her wedding day, the circling forefinger that shows the rise and fall of life. Everything new, she whispers again. In bed that night, I confide my worries to Richard, skirting over the Queen's infatuation for the Duke, but telling him only that she is lonely and that the Duke is her closest friend. Richard is sitting up beside the warmth of the fire, his gown thrown over his naked shoulders.
No harm in friendship, he says stoutly. And she's a pretty girl, and deserves some companionship.
People will talk.
People always talk.
I'm afraid that she may become too fond of the Duke.
He narrows his eyes as if he would scrutinize my thoughts. Are you saying she might fall in love with him?
I wouldn't be surprised if she did.
She's young. He is handsome. She has nobody else in the world who shows any sign of caring for her. The King is kind to her and considerate. But he has no passion in him. Can the King give her a child? Richard asks bluntly, going to the very core of the matter.
I think he can, I say. But he does not come often to her room.
The man's a fool, my husband says. A woman like Margaret cannot be neglected. Do you think the Duke has eyes for her?
I nod. Richard scowls.
I think you could trust him to do nothing that would endanger her or the throne. It would be a selfish villain who would seduce her. She has everything to lose, and it would cost the throne of England as well. He's no fool. They're close. They're bound to be close. They are both in attendance on the King for most of every day. But Edmund Beaufort is running this kingdom through the King. He wouldn't jeopardize his own future. Never mind hers. The most important thing is for her to get an heir. She can hardly do it alone, I say crossly. He laughs at me. No need to defend her to me. But while there's no child, then Richard, Duke of York, is the rightful heir. But the King keeps favouring others of his family. Humphrey, Duke of Buckingham, who takes precedence, and Edmund Beaufort. Now I hear he's bringing his half-brothers, the Tudor boys, to court as well. It makes everyone uneasy. Who does he think is his heir? Would he dare to put Richard, Duke of York, aside for one of these favourites?
He's young, I say. She's young. They could get a child.
Well, he's not likely to die on campaign like his father, my husband, the soldier, says cruelly. He keeps himself safe enough.
At the end of the 12 days of Christmas, Richard has to go back to his post at Calais. I go down to the river to see him set sail. He's wearing his thick travelling cloak against the cold wintry mist, and he wraps it around us both as we stand on the quayside. Inside the warmth, my head against his shoulder, my arms tight around his broad back, I hold him as if I cannot bear to let him go. I'll come to Calais, I promise.
Sweetheart, there's nothing for you there at all. I will come home again at Easter, or earlier.
I can't wait till Easter.
Then I will come sooner, whenever you bid me. You know that. When you want me, I will come.
Can't you just go and inspect the garrison and come back?
Perhaps. if there's no expedition into Normandy this spring. The Duke hopes to mount one. Does the Queen say anything?
She says whatever the Duke says.
If we don't have an expedition by spring, there won't be one this year, and I can come home to you, he promises.
You'd better come home in the summer, I warn him. Whatever happens, I will have something I will want you to see.
In the warm shelter of the cloak, his hand goes to my belly. You are a ruby, my Jaqueta. A wife of noble character, worth more than rubies. Are you with child again?
Yes, again, I say.
A summer baby, he says, with pleasure. Another for the House of Rivers. We are making a nation, my love. The rivers are becoming an estuary, a lake, an inland sea. I giggle. Will you stay at court with the Queen for now?
Yes, I will. I'll go down to Grafton for a few days to see the children, and then I'll come back to court. At the very least, I can guard her from slander. Concealed by his cloak, he squeezes me.
I like the thought of you as a model of respectability, my love.
I am a very respectable mother of nine, I remind him. Soon 10, God willing.
Good God, that I should feel like this for a mother of 10, he remarks, taking my hand and holding it against his breeches.
God forgive that I should feel like this for a married man and a father of 10, I say, pressing against him. There is a shout from the deck of the ship above us.
I have to go, he says reluctantly. We have to catch the tide. I love you, Jaqueta, and I will come home soon. He kisses me hard and quickly, and then he steps back and runs up the gangplank to the ship. Without his cloak, without his warmth, without his smile, I feel very cold and alone. I let him go. The Tower of London, Spring, 1453.
I come back to court after a week at Grafton in time for the great celebration in the Tower of London, where the King's half-brothers, Edmund and Jasper Tudor, are made earls. I stand beside the Queen as the two young men kneel before the King for their investiture. They are the sons of Queen Catherine of Valois, the King's mother, who made a second marriage as imprudent as my own. After her husband Henry V died, leaving her a widow with a baby, she did not, as everyone hoped, retire to a nunnery and spend the rest of her life in respectable grief. She stooped even lower than I did, and fell in love with a keeper of her wardrobe, Owen Tudor, and married him in secret. She left an awkward situation when she died, with Tudor as her surviving widower, or abductor, depending on your judgment, and his two sons as half-brothers to the King of England, or two bastards to a madly incontinent Queen Mother, depending on your charity. King Henry has decided to acknowledge his half-brothers, deny his mother's shame, and count them as royal kinsmen. What this will do to the expectations of the several men who are in line to inherit the throne is beyond understanding. These Tudors will just add to the confusion around the throne. The King honours the Duke of Buckingham, who counts himself as the greatest Duke of England, but favours Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, above anyone else. And all the while his true heir is the only man not here, and never welcomed at court, Richard Plantagenet, Duke of York. I glance at the Queen, who must be shamed by her failure to solve all this by producing a son and heir. But she's looking down at her folded hands, her eyelashes veiling her expression. I see Edmund Beaufort look quickly away from her. His grace is generous to the Tudor boys, I remark. She gives a little start at my words.
Oh, yes. Well, you know what he's like. He can forgive anyone, anything. And now he's so afraid of the common people and of the York affinity
that he wants to gather his family around him. He's giving the boys a fortune in lands, and recognizing them as his half-brothers.
"It is good for a man to have his family around him," I say cheerfully.
"Oh, he can make brothers," she says. And the unspoken words, "but not a son," remain unsaid. As the winter nights become lighter, and the mornings become golden rather than grey, we receive great news from Bordeaux, where John Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury, 4 times the age of his page boy, sweeps through the rich cities of Gascony, wins back Bordeaux, and looks set to reclaim all the English lands. This sends the court into an ecstasy of confidence. They declare that first we will win back all of Gascony, and then we will win back all of Normandy, and Calais will be secure, and Richard will be able to come home. Margaret and I are on the river walk in the gardens at Westminster, wrapped in our winter furs but feeling the spring sunshine on our faces, and looking at the first daffodils of the season. "Jaquetta, you're like a lovesick girl," she says suddenly. I jump. I had been looking at the river and thinking of Richard over the sea in Calais. Furious, I'm sure, that he's not leading the campaign in Bordeaux. "I'm sorry," I say with a little laugh. "I do miss him. And the children." "He will be home soon," she assures me. "Once Talbot has won back our lands in Gascony, we can make peace again." She takes my arm and walks beside me. "It is hard to be parted from people whom you love," she says. "I missed my mother so much when I first came to England. I feared that I would never see her again. And now she writes to me that she is ill, and I wish I could go to her. I wonder if she would have sent me away if she had known what my life would be like, if she had known that she would never see me again, not even for a visit. She knows at least that the king is kind to you, and a gentle husband," I say. "When the Greys asked me for Elizabeth, my first thought was, would he be kind to her? I think every mother would want that for her daughter." "I so want to be able to tell her I'm with child," she says. "That would make her happy. That is the one thing she wants, that everyone wants. But maybe, this year, perhaps one will come for me this year." Her eyelids sweep down, and she smiles, almost to herself. "Oh, dear Margaret, I hope so." "I'm more contented," she says quietly. "I'm even hopeful. You need not fear for me, Jaquetta. It is true that I was very unhappy this summer, and even at Christmas time. But I'm more contented now. You were a good friend to warn me to take care. I listened to you. I thought about what you said. I know I must not be indiscreet. I've put the Duke at a distance, and I think everything's going to be all right." There is something going on here. I don't need the sight to see it. There is a secret here, and a hidden joy. But I cannot complain of her behaviour. She may smile on the Duke, but she's always at the side of the King. She doesn't linger with the Duke in the gallery, nor let him whisper in her ear any more. He comes to her rooms, as he's always done, but they talk of matters of state, and there are always companions with him and ladies with her. It is when she's alone or quiet among the crowd that I look at her and wonder what she's thinking when she folds her hands so demurely in her lap and gazes down, her eyes veiled, smiling to herself. "And how is your little girl?" she asks a little wistfully. "Is she well and fat and pretty, like all your babies always seem to be?" "Thank God she is strong and growing well," I say. "I called her Eleanor, you know. I sent them all Christmas fairings, and we had a couple of days of such fine weather when I was down with them. I took the older ones hunting, and the younger ones sledging. I will go back to see them at Easter." That night, the Queen dresses in her new gown of darkest red, a colour no one has seen before, especially bought for her from the London merchants. And we go into the king's presence chamber with the ladies behind us. She takes her seat beside the king, and the little Beaufort heiress, Margaret, comes into the room dressed far too ornately, paraded by her shameless mother. The child is wearing a gown of angelic white, trimmed with red silk roses, as if to remind everyone that she is the daughter of John Beaufort, first Duke of Somerset, a great name, but God forgive him, not a great man. He was Edmund Beaufort's older brother, but he made a fool of himself in France and came home and died, so promptly and conveniently, just ahead of a charge of treason, that Richard says it was by his own hand and was the only good thing he ever did for his family. This scrap of a girl with a great name and greater fortune is his daughter and the niece of Edmund Beaufort. I see her staring at me, and I smile at her. At once she flushes scarlet and beams. She whispers to her mother, obviously asking who I am, and her mother very rightly gives her a pinch to make her stand straight and silent, as a girl at court should do.
"I am giving your daughter in wardship to my dearly loved half-brothers, Edmund and Jasper Tudor," the king says to the girl's mother, the Dowager Duchess. "She can live with you until it is time for her to marry."
Amusingly, the child looks up as if she has an opinion about this. When no one so much as glances at her, she whispers to her mother again. She's a dear little thing, and so anxious to be consulted. It seems hard to me that she will be married off to Edmund Tudor and sent away to Wales. The Queen turns to me, and I lean forward.
"What do you think?" Margaret asks.
Margaret Beaufort is of the House of Lancaster. Edmund Tudor is the son of a Queen of England. Any child they conceive will have an impressive lineage. English royal blood on one side, French royal blood on the other, both of them kin to the King of England.
"Is the King making his brother overmighty?" the Queen whispers.
"Oh, look at her," I say gently. "She's a tiny little thing, and a long way from marriageable age. Her mother will keep her home for another 10 years, surely. You will have half a dozen babies in the cradle before Edmund Tudor can wed or bed her." We both look down the room at the girl whose little head is still bobbing up and down, as if she wishes someone would speak to her. The Queen laughs.
"Well, I hope so. Surely a little shrimp like that will never make a royal heir."
The next night, I wait for a quiet moment in the hour before dinner, when the Queen is dressed and the Duke and King have not yet come to our rooms. We are seated before the fire, listening to the musicians. I glance at her for her nod of permission, and then draw my stool a little closer. "If you are waiting for a chance to tell me that you are with child again, you need not choose your time," she says mischievously. "I can see it." I blush. "I'm certain it will be a boy.
I'm eating enough to make a man, God knows. I have had to let my belt out."
"Have you told Richard?"
"He guessed before he left."
"I shall ask the Duke to let him come home. You will want him at home with you, won't you?"
I glance at her. Sometimes the almost annual evidence of my reliable fertility makes her wistful. But this time she is smiling. Her joy for me is without shadow.
"Yes, I want him to come home, if the Duke can spare him."
"I shall command it," she smiles. "The Duke tells me he will do anything for me. It is a little request for a man who has promised me the moon." "I will stay at court until May," I say. "And then after my confinement I will join you on the summer progress." "Perhaps we won't go very far this year," she says.
"No?"
I am slow to grasp her meaning.
"Perhaps I, too, will want an easy summer."
At last, I understand her.
"Oh,
Margaret, is it possible? I thought you had the sight, she crows. And here I am, sitting before you, and I think... I'm almost certain... I clasp her hands. I think so, too. I see it now. I really do. There is something about her luminous skin and the curves of her body. How long? I've missed two courses, I think, she says. So I haven't told anyone yet. What do you think? And the king lay with you before Christmas and gave you pleasure? She keeps her eyes down, but her colour deepens. Oh, Jaquetta, I didn't know it could be like that. I smile. Sometimes it can. Something in her smile tells me that she knows at last, after 8 years of marriage, of the joy that a man can give his wife, if he cares to do so, if he loves her enough to want to make her cling to him and yearn for his touch. When would I be sure? She asks. Next month, I say. We will get a midwife I know and trust to talk with you and see if you have the signs, and then you can tell His Grace yourself next month. She doesn't want to write to her mother until she's quite certain, and this is a little tragedy, for while she's waiting for the signs that she is with child, a message comes from Anjou to say that Margaret's mother, Isabella of Lorraine, has died. It is 8 years since Margaret said goodbye to her mother and came to England for her wedding, and they were never especially close. But it is a blow to the young queen. I see her in the gallery with tears in her eyes, and Edmund Beaufort holding both her hands in his own. Her head is turned towards him, as if she would put her face to his broad shoulder and weep. When they hear my footsteps, they turn to me, still hand clasped.
Her Grace is distressed about the news from Anjou, the Duke says simply.
He leads Margaret to me.
Go with Jaquetta, he says tenderly. Go and let her give you a tisane, something for grief. It is hard for a young woman to lose her mother, and such a shame that you never told her.
He breaks off his words and puts the Queen's hands in mine.
You have something you can give her, don't you? She shouldn't cry and cry.
I have some well-known herbs, I say, carefully. Will you come and lie down for a little while, Your Grace? Yes, Margaret says, and lets me lead her away from the Duke to the seclusion of her rooms. I make her a tisane of Tipton's weed, and she hesitates before she drinks it. It will not hurt a baby.
No, I reply. It is very mild. You shall have a draught of it every morning for a week. Grief would be worse for a baby. You have to try to be calm and cheerful.
She nods.
And are you sure? I ask her quietly. The midwives told me that they were almost certain.
I am certain, she says. I will tell the king next week, when I miss my course again. But she does not tell him herself. Oddly, she summons his chamberlain.
I have a message for you to take to the king, she says. She is somber in her dark blue mourning clothes, and I'm sorry that the loss of her mother has taken the brightness from her joy. Still, when she tells the king, they will both be elated. I assume she's going to invite the king to come to her rooms, but she goes on.
Pray give my compliments to the king and my good wishes, and inform him that I am with child.
Richard Tunstall simply goggles at her. He's never been asked to take such a message in his life. No royal chamberlain ever has. He looks at me as if for advice, but I can do nothing but show by a little shrug that he'd better take the message that this queen wishes to send to her husband.
He bows and steps backward out of the room, and the guards close the door quietly behind him. I'll change my gown. The king is certain to come to me, she says. We hurry to her.